I'm going to bring an off-air conversation on air with David Sampson. It's a day earlier because I want to carve out tomorrow's local hour in Big Sioux for Heat Reaction as Game 4 is tonight. By the way, you can watch Game 4 along with the whole cast of characters on the show on our Twitch, Lebatard and Friends on Twitch. Follow us on Twitter. If you don't know exactly how Twitch works, don't worry. You're not the only ones. We'll post helpful links out there so you can watch the game with us. Also, today's Big Sioux is already out. It is a basketball roundtable. Basketball's most brilliant minds with Amin El-Hassan, Zach Harper, Izzy Gutierrez, and Jorge Sedano, and myself moderating to get you the Heat stuff you desire. So we turn our attention to David Sampson because it's a weekly thing. David, I've been watching the Marlins, and the Marlins, in watching them, I don't think this is a really good team. This isn't your traditional playoff team. Usually, playoffs are reserved for really good teams, especially in Major League Baseball, where you have 162-game season and very limited playoff spots available. Bit of a crazy year in Major League Baseball that's made it fun and given a bad team like the Miami Marlins, or at least not a great team in the Miami Marlins, let's be fair to them, an opportunity to win a World Series championship by getting in the tournament in one of the most random sports there is. I've been watching them a lot recently, and I kind of felt like this was going to start happening to them. Expectations start getting put on them. They're in playoff position. They can control destiny by just getting results against what the records tell us are bad teams, and now they're starting to dip in form. David, did you also kind of see this coming?
Well, no, because I think you're not thinking about one thing here in terms of the Marlins. They've got a great rotation. And in a season where there's expanded playoffs and you're going to have 500 teams, if not teams below 500, make it in the National League. You've got the Phillies right now under 500. You've got the Brewers and Reds and Giants right at 500 or a game over 500. And then you've got the Marlins. If I am the Dodgers or the Cubs or the Braves, I'm not that interested in facing Sixto Sanchez and Pablo Lopez and Sandy Alcantara and then seeing about having Rodgers maybe in the bullpen, who's one of their starters, knowing they've got some veterans in the bullpen with Boxberger and Kinsler. The question with the Marlins has been their offense. And they brought in Starling Marte, and they're hitting him in the two-hole, which is where you put your best hitter. And he's good. Don't get me wrong, but in terms of leading an offense, not good enough. He's a complementary piece to make a good offense great. So that's my biggest concern with the Marlins. But pitching wins in the playoffs. So if the Marlins do make it, I need them to win the World Series because I don't want them to ruin their perfect record. The only team in Major League Baseball history never having lost a series in the playoffs. So I need that to continue. So once they clinch, we are going to ride it all the way to the parade.
And I don't need to look this stat up. I say it with certainty. They are also the only multiple-time World Series champion that has never won its own division.
Well, that's for sure. That's a guarantee. The Marlins in their history have never won the division, and it really is amazing to me. It's something we talked about. And this is a debate we'd have in the clubhouse all the time. Would you rather be the Braves or the Marlins? And the Braves won their division for like 16 straight years, and they won one ring in 1996. Or would you? No, that was the Yankees. The Braves won it in, oh my God.
They beat the Indians, and I think they beat the Indians in 95?
95, yeah, is when the Braves won, yes. And they lost to the Yankees with Jim Leyritz in 96. So one World Series. Or would you rather be the Marlins, miss the playoffs every year, but when you make it, you win the ring, and you have two rings over that period versus the Braves' one ring.
This one's
easy. And there's two total opposite answers. Many people say, give me a chance. I want to be in the playoffs every year. Forget the ring.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite. I'll take 10 last place finishes to get two parades any day of the week.
Yeah, but the Braves have had the model that you guys were aspiring to. Let's get the fans invested. Let's get people out to the ballpark. Let's have a pennant chase every year. And we're not talking about four World Series titles. We're talking about two World Series titles and no playoff appearances after those World Series titles. So I would have to say, with relative ease, I'm signing up for what the Atlanta Braves have had in my lifetime over the Marlins. And I say that as someone that was a Marlins fan.
But if you watch the Braves games, so you say they've been so great with attendance, and I would argue that they had as many empty seats at Turner Field before they opened their new ballpark.
Well, that's a dirty little secret about baseball you guys don't have great attendance. You're asking a lot of your fan base. It's easy for football to fill up their stadiums when you're only asking them to come out eight times. But in terms of what you were selling, in terms of, hey, guys, you can come out because I got a great team, the Atlanta Braves are pretty much the template for the kind of success, regular season, year in, year out consistency in a sport where it's hard to achieve that.
So I'd say the Cardinals are an example. The Cubs are an example. The Giants are an example. But even the Indians, who had that long sellout streak, which was a record back in the day, like two windows ago, they then went from no fans to sold out, back to no fans. But one thing that always frustrated me in Miami, how many people go to Heat games every year? Let's say their capacity is 20,000.
Yeah, their capacity is just around 20.
And let's say there's 40 games. I know there's 41, but just say there's 40. So 20,000 times 40, get out the computer. That to me seems like 800,000. I may be wrong, but that's what I think it is.
20,000. This is, I am no speed cuber, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So yeah, that is 800,000. Look at you. Good at numbers.
Okay. The Marlins, now granted, they have twice as many games because they have 81 home games. But even in our worst years, no matter how, when I made up attendance, which I did every game, as you know, we always had more than 800,000 real people.
Hmm.
Always.
You say that, and I don't believe you.
No, I'm telling you. We always had more than 800,000.
You have like the people at the turnstiles with the clickers.
Clicker, turnstile, the whole package.
Yeah. How many of those are repeat customers? How many of those are...
Well, how many Heater repeat customers?
No, I understand.
I'm not throwing shade.
I know it came off that way. I apologize for how I said that. I'm just curious. How many of those are repeat customers?
So, interestingly enough, we study this. There's fewer repeat customers in baseball than there are in basketball, and fewer repeat customers in basketball than there are in football. So, let's give an example. When you have a season ticket plan where you have an 81-game plan, which is not many, you don't go to 81 games. If you do, you're a stalker, yeah. Right? We think in Miami, there were maybe 100 people who were silly enough and loyal enough to go to 81 games. It's impossible. It's too many. So the majority, you spread those tickets amongst different people, which is why tracking people who go to games is so difficult. We tried this technology where we could learn about our season ticket holders. When do they like their hot dogs? What inning are they eating them in? When's the last time they bought a shirt? So we can push a notification that, hey, there's a new shirt ready to be bought. And the problem is you've got different people using tickets every single game for your season ticket holders. Basketball, it's 41 games. You've got many more season ticket holders who are able to go to all, but certainly not the majority. When you're a full season ticket holder, if you go to 20 Heat games, you're considered avid. But in football, the majority of season ticket holders, if they've got 40,000 season ticket holders, 30,000 of those are going to the eight games.
Who would you say is your franchise's greatest fan? Because many people might point to Marlins, man, and I want to get into that in a little bit. Sign guy, for those that are...
Sign guy was great, but there's a couple who lives in Plantation. Their name are Bruce and Sue Friedman, and they go to every game. Christopher Beaton and his wife, Sally, have gone to every game forever. Now, in the 3 years I've been gone, the three seasons, I'm not sure if they're still doing that. But the Friedmans went to every community event. They went to every single game. There are people like that, and they're completely stable, as are the Beatons. But the reality is that is a commitment, right? I went to every game, and it's a schlep from Broward to go every night. Not to go 10 times, but to go every night. It's a lot, but I always love them for doing that.
Let's talk about Marlins, man. He made the orange jersey famous. He shows up at the biggest sporting events, and he's randomly wearing a Miami Marlins orange jersey. I think in the eyes of the nation, you can't get a more random fan at these sporting events. When did this guy start popping up on your radar? Were you watching a big sporting event and notice him just like everybody else? Or was this guy already a guy that had a reputation within the Marlins, is a guy that would show up and he kind of seems like he makes demands and he kind of thinks he's a big deal? Tell me the origins of Marlins, man.
So I'm going to tread carefully, sort of.
Really?
But not totally.
He's a lawyer, is he not?
With you.
He's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer, and his name is Lawrence. The thing about Marlins, man, is this. There was always anger within baseball about Marlins, man. Because, yes, owners, other owners did not appreciate that he was giving the Marlins any sort of attention, because there was always issues with the Marlins. Were they going to relocate? There were issues with the stadium, issues with me and Jeffrey, issues with us making trades, issues with us winning World Series. We were the least popular World Series winners because the payroll was low and people just were jealous and angry. And then Marlins man shows up. I'll never forget. I was at the World Series in Kansas City. And it's a sea of blue. And there's Lawrence sitting behind the plate in the orange jersey where it's so obvious. And, you know, he's now passed away. But the Glass family, that the father was David Glass, a wonderful man. And they would seethe at the possibility that the Marlins were getting any ounce of attention when they wanted it only on their team. And every single person in Major League Baseball thought that he was on our payroll. The commissioner from Selig to Manfred, the people in the marketing department, the people in broadcasting, they assumed that we were smarter than we were and that we paid him to do this. And we didn't pay him a penny. We did not give him one extra anything, even though he wanted it, because his view is that he was doing something for us, therefore we should be remunerating him. And my view was, Lawrence, you're a great guy, but you're a pain in my ass because I got to field calls from around baseball about you because they think that we're in cahoots. So I've got to not just be semi-distant, I have to be totally distant from you.
When did the ass start being made from Marlins, man? Because he popped up on my radar with that Royals World Series too. Was this something that you kind of caught wind of before it actually happened? Or did you learn about it like everybody else? And then were you surprised at his resources to start showing up at every big sporting event after that, still wearing the Marlins despite what appeared to be ongoing negotiations from him and you trying to get more stuff?
So he's been in negotiations with me always. Every year he wanted certain things. He wanted it from Jeter as well. And I was not easy to negotiate with because I did not want to appear as though I was doing anything for him I wouldn't do for someone else because of all the heat that was on me, not just here in Miami, but around baseball. But he had a bunch of demands that, you know, he had that Marlins car, that big orange car. I don't know whether it was a Cadillac. It was some sort of specially made custom car. And he wanted to park it on the West Plaza of the new ballpark. And I actually gave in and let him do it a couple of times. He loves getting attention is the bottom line. But he's also very charitable. He has no family to speak of. So to me, people criticize him. He just uses his disposable income in a way that we don't have the ability to, having family and kids and college tuition and various other things.
Did he ever threaten, hey, I might become Cardinals man. I might become Steelers man. Give in to what I'm asking, or there are teams lining up. And do you actually believe him if he actually used that tactic that there were teams lining up? Because I think I might believe that.
So I knew there were not teams lining up because I was always aware that what he would do if he would ever leave the Marlins is he would have a list of demands that were so great that people would come to me around baseball and say, hey, is the juice worth the squeeze? And I would say no, because I wouldn't want him to don another jersey. That said, he never got to the point where I was angry. I just got to the point where it was too big an allocation of my time. And so I handed it off to other people. And then he had my cell number. So there was a lot of texting back and forth. But he's not crazy. He's not mean. He's not rude. What he is, though, is someone who he very much loves being in the spotlight. He loves sort of the celebrity side of being noticed. But he took it personally. That was an issue. You know, part of the show, Nothing Personal. I think back to Lawrence. Everything's very personal to him. And I tried to explain that that's not the way to be if you're going to be rich and famous.
Well, then he must have been very hurt by how Derek Jeter handled the situation. So explain to me.
He called me Mike. Oh, my God.
All right. So this is part of the transition. This is one of the many bullet points in your sale. I think there's a whole file dedicated to Marlins, man. What kind of headache was this in the transition from you guys to Derek Jeter? How many times did Marlins, man, pop up?
So Derek Jeter asked me about Marlins, man, during the negotiation. and let's see how good you are. I know you are. What do you think my response would be when I'm in the middle of trying to do a billion-dollar transaction and he asks me about Marlins, man?
Whatever it is Derek Jeter wants to hear, you're saying it.
It's not even a question. I said, Derek, here's what I would do. Whatever you want. If you think that he is helpful in your new marketing strategy as you take over being the savior of the Marlins, getting rid of me and getting rid of Jeffrey, and you want to help him, he is perfect. If you think that you should ignore him and let him be, then I think you're exactly right. You should ignore him and let him be because he's going to be a pain in your ass. Whatever you think is right, speak to the people who you're working with who know way more than I do. And I remember this conversation that was yesterday because I'd spoken to Lawrence about the fact that he was going to go through an ownership transition. And he was asking me about thoughts about, you know, I'm looking for this. I want to make sure I get this and get this. I did not tell him that I'd spoken to Derek, of course, because I was not going to do that because there was, I was worried. Can you imagine if he had gone public or there had been some sort of issue publicly about this transaction, Ray Marlins, man, I would have lost my mind. So I wasn't going to let that happen.
Talk to me a little bit about Andy Slater, because Marlins, man, all of a sudden gets in kind of like a public beef with Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter just tries to cut him off. I think that there was a meeting with season ticket holders, and Marlins man just went on and wouldn't shut up. And then he uses Andy Slater as sort of a media mouthpiece. And then Andy Slater gets banned from the Marlins press box. Now, this happens after the transition from you guys to Derek Jeter. So I'm sure you know what happened there. Just give me your side of things.
So let me go back to Andy Slater. I couldn't stand him when I was president of the Marlins. And the reason why was he had sources in our clubhouse and I could never find out who they were. I always thought it was the training staff because he had injuries. He had player moves. So I thought it could have been someone in the clubby because clubbies know about player moves before the media. They know about it before just about anyone else because you have them literally, they get the first call along with the traveling secretary because you have to make a locker for them and you have to actually make a jersey for the players who are coming. And the players who are going, you clean out their locker and get rid of them. And Slater had all of these scoops before he called it Slater Scoop. And I was furious. I knew Slater. He used to be the TV guy. That's what he was known for. He was selling TVs to people in the clubhouse. All of a sudden, he's got these sources. Only after I left the Marlins did we become simpatico, and where now I speak to him and I've been on a, you know, we have an open communication. But he had this unique ability. Remember, by the way, and it's, this is a terrible segue.
Yeah, it's sort of synonymous with me because Andy Slater is a local newsbreaker. I found out that Jose Fernandez passed away from Andy Slater, and I know how much that affected you, and I'm sure you were furious at the time with Andy Slater because people should find out, okay, you're making a face. I thought for sure, given the sensitivity around it, you would have harbored some sort of resentment. I'm glad to see that whatever hatchet there was has been buried between you and Andy Slater.
Yeah, that's been buried. It's, you know, September 25th, which is, I don't know what day we are. Maybe this
September
is
23rd. Happy birthday, my daughter, Juliet.
Hey, happy birthday, Juliet. What number?
Number one.
Okay, so that's a big one. So enjoy that. They go quickly. So 2 days from now, it'll be 4 years since Jose died. And I can't believe it's 4 years. And that morning, Andy Slater did break the news. And I didn't have time or it wasn't even a thought. I wasn't angry that morning. What I knew was, is once Slater had broken the news, that I had to move faster to get players into the ballpark and to get a meeting going and to figure out what was going to happen that day. I was very angry, not at him, but we had no proof that his mom had been told yet. So we had actually been told that she hadn't. And I was angry because if she finds out this way, it's just not right. And I had gotten the call about it and had confirmed it about an hour and a half earlier than that, when I had spoken to the fish and wildlife guys who were on site, but Slater got it. And I've spoken to him in the years since then about this issue. And I acknowledge that when you have news like that confirmed, it's your job. You have to do it. But it's one of those things when you're in the media, that's a terribly upsetting story to have to break, but you got no choice. And I respected him for it.
So did Andy Slater come up in your discussions with Jeter as you're preparing this handoff? So then it doesn't come up. So then what's Derek Jeter's experience with Andy Slater? Because Andy Slater finds himself banned from the Marlins press box.
So I'm not sure that that's true. I haven't spoken to Andy about that. What I do believe is he did not get a seasonal pass and that he has to apply every day to get permission, and that when he applies, he gets accepted. Listen, the Marlins PR people, led by this guy named Latimer. I don't remember
Jason
his first
Latimer.
Name. He is, to me, not qualified to do what he does, and I'm not sullying his reputation. It is what it is.
I've spoken to Jason a little bit, and I remember him. He came from another team. My conversations with him have been good. When Derek Jeter comes over, he gets, like, his media relations guys. Everybody gets blown out. You had Matt Roebuck was also a media relations guy for you guys for a long time. Did you guys ever blackball a certain member of the press the way that it appeared publicly that Andy Slater was being blackballed?
Yes, we blackballed Mike Berardino. Do you remember that name? He used to be down here.
But he was reputable, wasn't he not?
I don't care what he was reputable. He's the one who wrote that Baseball America article when we moved from the Expos to Florida. And he's the one who went with the story that we stole stuff from Montreal and brought it to Florida, that we fired all the Florida employees, which was wrong. John Henry got rid of the Florida guys as part of the agreement to go to the Red Sox. And we were blamed for being loyal to our Expos employees who we brought to Florida. And Mike Berardino did that cover where it was Billy the Marlin and Yuppie being hung literally in an... Actually, I don't remember this cover perfectly. There could have been a noose on the cover, ironically, back in 2002 when this happened. And we did not ever talk to him or allow him anywhere. And to this day, Mike Hill, Larry Beinfest, and I, when we have to use the bathroom, we say to this day, excuse me, we're going to go take a Berardino.
Oh, my God.
It's been 18 years and we haven't stopped. I found him to be, and this is not personally, I'm talking about professionally. He was squirrely, and this is not being personal, be clear. He was only interested in writing things that would make us look bad.
Hold on. You can't give me the nothing personal line.
I am.
When you're going,
he may be a great husband, a great father, a great friend. I don't know anything about him personally, Mikey.
Okay, but you're taking a dump and calling it a Berardino.
Yes, I am.
That doesn't feel like just business.
By the way, with me, it definitely is just business. But I would say I understand what you're saying. That it sounds like I'm holding a grudge, which is funny because I'm not a grudge holder at all.
This is absolutely a grudge. This is the one time. This is the chink in the armor. This is the chink in the nothing personal armor. This was absolutely personal with you.
We held a grudge that continues to this day because we've gotten crushed. You know, Jeff Passan is someone who has been all over me for 20 years. I've never met the guy. Our head of communications, PJ Loiello, asked me whether I'd slept with his wife. That's how personal Passan was. And I don't know whether he's married, actually.
Passan hates you guys.
It's unreal.
I would love the work that he did because I was not the biggest fan of Jeffrey, as you can imagine. And I still, like, anytime you guys did anything, I would dial up Passan because he would explain it in a way that was just...
I've never met him. He never called to get a quote. He never called to get the other side of a story. But we didn't have an issue with him the way we did with Berardino, because Berardino we had to see every day because he was on the beat down here in Florida. But Passan's just a guy. You know, his career has ascended. He's obviously you can't say anything about him.
I wouldn't say anything about him even when he was in Yahoo. He's the best newsbreaker in that sport.
So that's his job, right? He's got sources. He's a newsbreaker. That's not, you know, it is what it is.
Wasn't always his job, though. At Yahoo, he would write articles, and you guys were caught in the crosshairs quite a bit.
And he had no facts. That's what was unbelievable about him. He never took the time to check the story or to see what was going on. It was extremely personal with him, and we never knew why. So I know a lot of guys in the media over my 18 years running the teams. I never met him. I literally, to this day, I've never met him. He and I both go on a station in Canada and we don't go on together, but he still harbors anger toward me in a way that is so bizarre because A, I'm 3 years removed. B, I don't know what I did to him. Clearly it's something because that is personal between Passan and me. It's just not returned because I don't spend a moment's thought thinking about it.
If you want to do another uncomfortable local hour, I can bring Jeff Passan on and we can talk this thing out.
I would do it in 1 second. And I would love to get him. He's never spoken to me. I would love to bring him on and find out what his problem is. Just articulate to me in paragraph form what it is about you that makes you the way you are. I promise you this, unless ESPN makes him, which you know very well, they will not. You will ask him to come on the show and he will say no.
All right, we'll see. I'll reach out to him.
But you have to be honest and tell him that it's for with me.
Yeah. I'm not gonna do that to him. I'm not this gotcha guy.
Right.
People gotta know. I didn't do that with Ariel. Like it's very transparent what's going on here. I keep following these different tangents, but I do want to get to the Andy Slater, Derek Jeter problem. I know you identified exactly what it was. He presented it in public like as if he were banned, and it was really not withholding a season pass. Your perspective on how that thing goes down, it seemed like a public misstep because Slater was then later allowed to sort of claim victory publicly, which is not something you want to really give the person if you do indeed have some sort of issue. And I'm wondering how many times, if you were reached out to by Slater while this thing was going on, and if so, how many times do people from the outside that you dealt with from your time with the Marlins are reaching out to you to try to smooth over something, some issue that they have with Derek Jeter?
So what Derek Jeter fails to understand is I was in this community for 16 years, and whatever you think my reputation was, I still have connections in the community. I still speak to people in the community, and Derek Jeter would go around and Latimer would go around and they're sulling me, and the people they're sulling me to are then picking up the phone and calling me to say, can you believe what was just told to me? So they did not realize how deep my ties were. And it's an obsession that Latimer has. With me, that's still bizarre that Jeter has. I'm still the number one enemy there in that organization. They follow everything we do. They listen to every one of the shows. They read every one of the tweets, and they try to get me. I did a show on Fox with Steve Shapiro. I think that's Fox here locally. I can't.
WSVN. So yeah, you did the like the sports rap that Drew Rosenhaus is on,
and. The Marlins, I found out not from Shapiro, from someone else within that studio. They said, you can't have Samson on your show. If you do, we're not going to let anyone from the Marlins be on your show. Trying to tell Fox that Samson, he's nothing. He's gone. He's nobody. Stop giving him a microphone because they're so worried that I'm going to tell the truth about Derek Jeter, who has spent his career hiding himself and making himself Teflon. But what he never realized is when you're a player, you can be Teflon. But when you're an owner, you simply cannot be. And he tried to bully the media the way he did as a player, and it doesn't work. So they did it with Slater, and Slater laughed. Like, people thought in Jeter's camp when he bought the Marlins that he'd walk into Fox and renegotiate a TV deal, or he'd walk into the corporate sales companies and get a naming rights deal and just say, hey, I'm Derek Jeter. Give me the money. And it just doesn't work that way. But now it's been 3 years. I think he's very clear how it works here in Miami. And again, don't misunderstand. I want the Marlins to win the damn World Series for Michael Hill and for the people of Miami who why not get a third ring? How great would that be?
That'd be fantastic. And it'd be the most bizarre three-time champion, I think, of all of sports because of how dysfunctional it is. Although, look, Reinsdorf won a World Series with the White Sox and had a dynastic team with the Chicago Bulls. And I think it's kind of been proven over a large enough sample that even though he's won trophies, not the greatest owner. There's a lot of turmoil within those front offices and those teams. You actually, in the last episode, you were telling me about how when it came to Rob Manfred getting elected, it was basically Reinsdorf on one side and you were sort of leading the charge on the other side in trying to get Manfred elected. He was the opposition. What is Jerry Reinsdorf's reputation within baseball? Because if I had to identify a bad owner, it would be Jerry Reinsdorf right now.
I don't know why you say that, because he is a great owner and his reputation is outstanding. This is the greatest NBA owner. Now, you could say he had Jordan and that's what happened, but there's plenty of unbelievable players, not the GOAT, but plenty of unbelievable players who don't have multiple rings. Now, granted, since Krause left, I mean, the Bulls have not been successful. They have a new coach now. Maybe Billy Donovan will help. By the way, is Billy Donovan getting negative attention for being hired? Or is it positive attention in your mind?
It seems pretty positive. It probably wouldn't have been were not for this year, because Oklahoma City had a surprisingly good season. Chris Paul was an all-star again, and Billy Donovan was credited for a lot of that.
I'm asking because it's, you know, when Steve Nash got hired, there was a lot of talk on all the networks about privilege and how that works. And now Billy Donovan's hired. I just hadn't read whether or not that had continued.
They had an interview process, and Billy Donovan has bona fides. He's had success. He's been a head coach, obviously. He's coming over from Oklahoma City. Steve Nash wasn't ever a head coach. So
right.
He gets hit with the privilege stuff. Although, if you look at the history of coaches in that sport that had no head coaching experience that were previous players, it's actually probably an advantage to like the people of color in terms of the players that do that, rather than, you know, they were using this as an example of white privilege. And I thought it was a good conversation, and it was one of those that I think people sort of stood back and realized, oh, there's a representative sample here that maybe we should walk that back. This actually is more like a point guard privilege, if anything.
It's like a catcher's privilege in baseball.
Right.
Right. If you're a catcher, you have a best chance to become a manager. Some of the best managers are catchers. And we've also learned some of the best players in the NBA. What I'd be worried about with Steve Nash is that, forgetting color, the reality is the better you were as a player, the less likely it is that you're going to be a great coach. The best coaches were more fringe players. Phil Jackson, a great sixth man, but not a Hall of Famer. You have Pat Riley, who was an average at best player. And then you sort of say, look at what Larry Bird and Isaiah Thomas, they just couldn't coach because they see the game so differently. It's like Barry Bonds can't coach. He just cannot teach people to hit because he's too good at it.
Yeah, Larry Bird was a good coach, but they kind of get frustrated quickly. Using Magic Johnson as an example, Dan uses this all the time. When Magic Johnson became head coach and he had a very short stint with the Lakers, he would just get so frustrated because the game came so easy to him when players couldn't do what he could do. This is one of the greatest basketball players of all time. So it's very difficult for someone that has reached the absolute heights of that sport to coach and teach when other players just simply aren't Magic Johnson or Steve Nash.
And Steve Nash is one of the great players. He's one of the great point guards of all time, certainly in the conversation.
Before Steph, I would have said Steve Nash is the greatest shooter I've ever seen. And he's not talked about that way, really, which is upsetting to me because he was a fantastic shooter.
Talked about as a playmaker more than as a shooter, but he could definitely shoot. So anyway, going back to your Reinsdorf, he is a, if I can land that plane, he's not.
I'm still trying to land the Andy Slater plane. I'm failing miserably.
He's very well thought of. You know, he's like, he's the old sage is what Jerry Reinsdorf is. He's won a World Series. He's won NBA championships. He sits in a room. He's got this great presence, but he's also can be grumpy and ornery. And if you cross him, it can end up costing you. So there's a lot to Jerry Reinsdorf.
As a fan, I just want my team to win by any means necessary. Right? I don't care about your finances. I hope you take a loss every year. Go well into the luxury tax. I'm paying for season tickets. I'm buying all the merch. I'm watching every game. You ask a lot of me as a fan, as a patron. You do the same. Don't treat this like a business. This is a tribalism at its finest, right?
I can't tell if you're being serious or not.
Well, no, I want my teams. I don't give a shit about the luxury tax that Mickey Arison spends. I want to win. I want to win. That's what you sell me. Championship winning culture. Okay, so do anything possible to win because you're a billionaire.
So when the Heat made moves and they 100% made moves to stay under the luxury tax.
Absolutely, 100%.
That bothered you?
It would bother me in the sense that the Mike Miller was the only time that it bothered me because I thought Mike Miller could still help the team. And that was a move that was just purely so they wouldn't go into the luxury tax. And it ended up, you could research this, LeBron James, even though he likes to pretend he wasn't, he was clued into this move being made, and then he liked to pretend that he wasn't. And that was a cost-cutting move. But all the other luxury tax moves that the Miami Heat have made, they've been getting rid of bad players somehow, some way, getting out from Tyler Johnson's contract. So at that point, yeah, great. But yeah, they're not without fault in that regard. But here's my point on Jerry Reinsdorf. Jerry Reinsdorf became mega rich because of the sports, because of the franchises he owned. It's a family business, sports, for that team. And I think you see some of the more poorly run franchises, you see a lot of dysfunction when that is the main source of income. And your team somehow oftentimes pays the price for their mismanagement. So Jerry Reinsdorf, that is a family business. That is, professional sports is a chief source of income. It became the breadwinner within their family. And I thought that they made so many moves that affected their own pocketbook that ended up hurting the actual team. So I just think of them as a bad owner, despite all the success.
Are the people you work for bad because they make cost-cutting moves and they do things in order to maintain some possible semblance of profitability?
You're asking me to say, are my bosses bad?
I'm asking you to say, do you have concerns in your industry when moves are made and salaries are cut or things happen in order to ensure profitability for people who make 20 times as much and are worth 100 times as much as you are?
Yeah, I fear it every time. And I can only expect that another one is coming down the pike here. I've survived three ESPN layoffs. Those are never fun to go through. I understand the reality of the situation is I understand that I work for the Walt Disney Company, and I'm not going to give you what you're looking for. I'm not going to call my bosses bad for doing that.
I'm not asking you to call your bosses bad. I'm asking you to think about when you go to Epcot. Mm-hmm. Do you get upset when you pay $85 knowing that the people who run Disney and the people who are the largest shareholders are wealthy beyond any of our imaginable dreams? Does it bother you when they raise the price of a Disney Mickey's ears by 75 cents? How do you feel when that happens?
Very hard for me to have a reference point because as a Disney employee, I get in there for free and I have all sorts of discounts.
Okay. By the way, I'm not even slightly appreciating how you're skating on this because it's so obvious that you're not.
Yeah, okay. I understand.
You understand my point. You're a fan.
You win. You win. I understand your point.
I don't want to win, but you're a fan. And what you're saying is, you just said it. I don't care if the owners lose money every year, if they go into the luxury tax.
Right.
It is not their right to make a living off that business that they own.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of statement is that?
Right.
It is the right of everyone who owns a business to make a living off the business they own.
Yes. And if I did give you what you want, I think that you would see that I'm pretty consistent across the board with this specific take. But in terms of sports in general, they're the ones, their whole marketing campaign is support us. We are one. We are going for this together. We can't do it. You guys are the best fans in the world. It just taps into that tribal part of us. So when I feel like, oh, wait, you don't actually share the commitment to winning, it's all just a bunch of marketing mumbo jumbo, I kind of get bothered by that.
Mikey, it's all marketing mumbo jumbo in every industry. When you watch commercials for the airlines who are saying, we value your loyalty.
Yeah.
We want you to
come sucker.
Fly.
I'm a sucker, especially when it comes to professional sports.
We're
absolutely
all suckers.
Yeah. Well,
that's what marketing is.
Yeah. I'll buy it. I like sports. I like my teams. I identify with my teams. And I just want to believe that everyone in there is trying their damnedest to win.
They're not.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That's a bummer. That's not what I, when I grew up on sports, that's not what I bought into.
Getting old sucks. When you realize, by the way, it's going to happen. It'll happen with when you start seeing the warts of your parents. And I'm not talking about your parents specifically. I'm saying in general, as we get older.
I'll give you what you want there in terms of seeing the warts of my parents. No problem.
You learn more things about people and the world as you get older. It's why the innocence of kids is such a beautiful thing to watch, because the cynicism that adulthood brings is hard to shake once it arrives.
I mean, if what's happening during the pandemic can't open your eyes to what's going on with the business of sports, just in college sports, because this is... if you were to believe anything about community and for the love of the game, and we're a team with one common goal and we're playing for the passion of stuff, you wouldn't be putting these kids out there. I mean, the Notre Dame game just got canceled. I want to believe.
Oh, you're funny. You, by the way, you're our dream. When you run a sports team, a fan sucker like you is our dream. Yeah. You're a total sucker.
But it's also why I took what you guys did so personally, and why I'm watching now just so I can support my friends that still like the Marlins. But this is a very different viewing experience for me. The Marlins can lose important games, and God, I would watch those Jorge Cantu teams every day. And if they lost the rubber match between in regular season game 57, I would wear it the next day. It would affect my mood, a regular season loss. And now they're losing to the Nationals with the playoffs on the line, and I don't care.
But you realize, of course, that you're also getting older. And you have other priorities in your life now.
No, because I care when Chelsea lose to Liverpool. I care when the Browns lose week one to the Ravens. I just don't care anymore about the Marlins. So your capacity, though,
Mike, is going to decrease as you get older, because there's only 100% of your brain and your emotions that can be occupied. When your one-year-old becomes 12, and there are teenage issues going on, and then you start thinking about high school and thinking about her life and making sure that things go well, and you can't watch the Browns or Chelsea because you're going to a recital or you're doing something else. I assure you,
it'll happen.
That what you think is never going to happen, I guarantee you
it'll happen. It happened with baseball, and this speaks to the sport, how it evolved, how I found it boring. Honestly, smartphones really, since there's so much downtime when I attended games, I went to like 3 Marlins games at the new stadium. A guy hit for the cycle I didn't even know, because I was just doing other things. I was enjoying the Clevelander. I was in my phone. I had no idea what was going on. I'm just sucked into my apps that, oh, there's a baseball game going on. It's not the constant action where I have to keep my eyes on the screen. It is a bandwidth thing. I think my passion for music and live music, attending concerts and seeking out music, sort of filled that baseball void. But since you guys tapped into that tribalism, I felt so betrayed that when it came time to, I need to erase stuff off my drive, easy call. You guys were first.
Yeah. And I've it's bothered me always, because you're not the only one. Mm-hmm. And obviously I'm haunted by decisions we had to make from a business standpoint, because I don't like toying with people's emotions, because I used to be that.
Yeah.
Remember when I was from 1975, when I was 7 years old, until 1999, when I was 31, my life was the New York Knicks. Mm-hmm. I would stretch before games. I thought I was the number one fan, and I went to games. I watched games. I would not go out when there was a Knick road game. I wouldn't watch at a bar without sound. I needed to be home watching games. I was at the University of Wisconsin, and me and a guy named Barry Baum.
You went to UW?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Madison, Wisconsin. You're a Badger.
Badger.
I had no idea.
I'm a Badger, a proud Big Ten Badger. And we'd watch every Knick game. In college.
Was Stan Van Gundy the coach of the basketball team when you were there?
No.
No, that was a little bit after?
Yeah. I was there 1987 to 1990.
Okay.
So a long time ago. The point is that I was a huge, huge fan, and getting into the sport ruined my fandom. I'm not a fan of any sports now, which is disappointing. But also as I got older, it just changed in terms of my bandwidth. And you're describing it perfectly. When I started being a fan, smartphones, are you kidding? There were no cell phones.
Yeah.
So you go to a game and you're focused. If you went to a baseball game without your cell phone because they didn't exist, you would watch it and engage with it totally differently than you do now.
Yeah, no doubt. Man, the poorest job of moderating one of these, I think, because I still don't have an answer to the Andy Slater question that I was going for. So Jeter, in the public eye, blackballs Andy Slater. What does Andy Slater do? Does he reach out to you to smooth things over? How does this thing get fixed? How often are you hearing from Derek Jeter about problems? Still, does Derek Jeter or the Marlins, or is that done? No one's reaching out to you anymore.
They haven't reached out to me since the day I walked out the door, October 1st.
Okay.
Of 2017.
All right.
Not one time.
All right.
They would never reach out to me.
All right. So
the reason they would not reach out to me is that they loathe and hold in contempt everything that I stand for, everything that I represent. And they thought that separating themselves from me would make it happen.
Yeah.
And it has. Listen, after 3 years, they've got a team. They have built a great farm system. They built a team that is showing it can be a 500 team, and if not better. And again, people misunderstand. I'm rooting for the Marlins because, first of all, I want the Marlins.
You want Mike Hill?
Always, huh?
You're rooting for Mike Hill.
I'm rooting for us. I'm a South Floridian. I want the Heat and Marlins to win a title the same year. That was always my goal, to see how many of our sports teams could do it, because I was always offended by the reputation that we have outside of Miami. Outside of Miami, when you travel to other cities, we're a joke.
Yep.
Including Dolphins, Heat, Panthers, Marlins. The Heat are not immune from this. Mm-hmm. We are viewed as a horrible sports city with horrible people, horrible fans. And I wanted there to be winning. And the Panthers, Dolphins, and Marlins were not helpful after 03. When the Heat had their great run with the Big Three, I wanted someone else in our town to win, to see what it would be like to be Boston.
Yeah.
To win multiple championships at once, and it's never happened.
You kind of saw it a little bit, because after LeBron ripped everything away by leaving, and then Chris Bosh had the blood clots, which is sort of hand in hand with why the Heat couldn't keep that consistency and had to rebuild, and credit to them, because this is amazing considering the bad luck that they've had. Remember when the Miami Hurricanes played your Badgers in an Orange Bowl? They had that one good year. Turnover change. They really captured the hearts of the South Florida sports fan that was just so desperate for a winner. I think football is so well positioned for it in this town. But I do think the Miami Heat have made a massive dent, because growing up, this was a football town through and through. Not even close, because of all the success the Dolphins had early on in their years. And then Marino just, they read that, they kept riding that wave with Shula and Marino. But then the Heat, they have now generations that have witnessed winning. 2006, people that were little kids in 2006 are parents now. And they have just, believe it or not, people that were like 10 years old, 9 years old, watching Shaq and Wade lift a trophy. Some of those people are parents now, and they have raised their children. True. They're raising their children.
Freaking me out.
It is, right? It's crazy. Raising their children in a sports town in which it is very clear who the top dog is in terms of success. And the ratings bear it out. Massive, massive dent into making this a more basketball town than football town.
I never thought that it would be anything other than a football town, but I also never thought that I'd live here for 18 years. And I don't think I've witnessed, have I witnessed a Dolphins playoff victory since I moved here in 02? Have they won a playoff game since I moved here?
No, there was that victory. When did that victory against the Colts, Lamar Smith went crazy? That might've been 2001. Hang on, Lamar Smith.
I believe since I moved here, they've made the playoffs once or twice and not won a game. And now, again, 18 years, that's kids who are born are now going to college.
Yep, you're right.
So you missed a generation of winning. And that's happening with the Marlins.
Lamar Smith and the Miami Dolphins, on a record-setting day from Lamar Smith, he had so many carries, they beat the Colts at the very end of the 2000 season. It was December 30th, 2000. So the Miami Dolphins have not won a playoff game. They've made a couple of playoff appearances since you showed up, but they have not won a playoff game.
So that's 20 years. So you're talking about kids who are born are now have moved away and they're in school and they've moved on. And during that period, the Heat have won championships. The Marlins have won one championship and the Dolphins haven't even won a playoff game. So is it possible that Miami will become a Dolphins, you know, again? Steve Ross wants that. He's tried as hard as he can, right?
He seems to me like players. He's a good owner too. He seems to me like he's a very good owner.
Now we're going to get into it. Why is Steven Ross a good owner? What has he done? Wait a minute. I think I know. Because he spends money every year bringing in top players. Is that why?
Not just the top players. The repairs to the stadium out of his own pocket. No, I'm not going to use taxpayer dollars. I'm going to improve the facilities, your game experience. I'm going to dig into my own pocket because I care so much.
I'm nauseous.
What?
I'm literally nauseous.
What? He didn't have the scandal surrounding his stadium upgrades that you guys did.
why don't you do a little research and find out how the Dolphins renovations got funded, if you don't mind.
Well, tell me. I don't want to do the research. Tell me.
Really? Yeah. Do you want to find out what public incentives they got and the money they get from the county every year?
They definitely
get interested in knowing they get money.
Yeah, I know that they get tax breaks for doing it, but it didn't go to vote, right? They didn't have the referendum.
What are you talking about? When you get tax breaks, whether you're Burger King or the Dolphins or the Marlins or the corner grocery store or Amazon, that is getting public money to do private business.
Because that's less money. That's less money going to the public. Right.
It's not even a question. Number two, did the Dolphins use any money from the NFL to do any of their renovations?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
So there's an entire fund with the NFL that helps. It's called the G4. And that is money that is used, collective
really?
Money, that is used to give to owners to put into their stadiums.
Huh.
So you're saying that Steve Ross dipped into his pocket. Every investment he's made, and I respect him because he's a businessman.
Yeah.
He is a businessman. If you think he invested in renovating Hard Rock because out of the goodness of his heart and his love of Miami, then you are a Kool-Aid drinker. Yeah. It is a straight business transaction.
I didn't know about this G4 fund.
Check me out one time. Read about the G4 fund and what the NFL does of helping.
Okay. I know you have a very high level business acumen. This is not knowledge.
But Mikey, what I'm trying to say is that you're here saying that Steve Ross is the greatest owner.
Optics.
But I thought you're measuring owners by winning.
I'm not a Dolphin fan. I'm not a Dolphin fan, so that's easy for me to say. But I did it with Ryan Surf. No, you call me out on the hypocrisies. I'll give you dubs on these, man. I did not know about this G4 Stadium program at all.
But by the way, that shouldn't matter to you. What should matter is that even you're not a Dolphins fan, but you're commenting on Stephen Ross as an owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're saying, yeah, he's a great owner.
Yeah, because he dipped into his own pockets and he paid for stadium repairs. That's how it was sold.
So now what you're saying is, as a fan, you're the type of fan who I'm never going to win over, because what you're saying is winning actually doesn't matter. You just want money spent and losses incurred by your owner.
No, winning matters. Winning matters, even though I'm also a Browns fan and they do no winning, but I'm pissed at the owner. I don't think Jimmy Haslam's a good owner at all. So what's happening here is I'm calling him a good owner because he's just dipping into his own pockets. But if I were a Dolphin fan, I wouldn't give a shit about him dipping into his own pockets because my team sucks.
It's such an inconsistent platform that you have right now that I'm not fully understanding how you.
I would give a shit about him dipping into his own pockets because it's not going to a vote and we're not getting tax dollars, as long as I understand it. Even though you gave a great explanation as to why it was still publicly funded by tax breaks. But I would hold the lack of on-field success against him if I were a Dolphin fan.
But do you hold it against Jimmy Haslam?
Yes, absolutely.
But what if Jimmy Haslam were losing money?
Still would hold it against him. He's made so many bad decisions.
So now it's not about losing the money. It's about actually the on-field performance and the bad decisions.
Right.
What if he made good decisions that you thought were good, but they still weren't winning?
You've tied me into a knot here when the premise was built on, I know Jerry Reinsdorf has won titles, and I still call them a bad owner because I just have this thing. If it's a family business and that's a main source of income for the family, I feel like you're going to cut corners, cut costs, to the detriment of the on-field product. My problem with Jimmy Haslam is I don't think he's cutting corners. I think the problem is he's just making bad decisions, right? It's not for a lack of trying. The guy desperately wants to win, which, you know, it wins me over some.
So if Jeffrey was losing money or not losing money, making whatever you think he was doing.
Yeah. Jeffrey.
And signing players who didn't, and Jeffrey is a trigger for you, but take a different owner where you're making trades, you're making signings, you're drafting kids, you have high picks, they're very highly thought of. No one is saying, wow, I can't believe you signed Mark Burley. That's a terrible signing. And I mean, my point is, they didn't work out. Mm-hmm. Like, I go back to the ugly years, bringing in Dan Ugla watching him play with Cody Ross and Jorge Cantu.
Great teams.
Awesome.
Those are great teams.
But we couldn't make the playoffs. We just couldn't get over the top,
right,
for whatever the reason was.
You guys tried, but you were doing it with one hand tied behind your back because you were operating a business. I do feel like if you guys had the resources, even though the one time that you guys did get resources, you John Bucked it. But I always felt like, man, they are maximizing right now with their budget. They got Carlos Delgado. I was so happy. They're trying within the restraints of their budget. And I always felt like if they increased the budget, the Marlins could get better. I felt like you guys were so close to the playoffs and you guys only had yourself to blame because you weren't getting more resources.
We weren't good enough. We weren't smart enough. We didn't make the right moves. That's why we never made the playoffs, is we didn't do the right complementary moves. We were going fiery managers too quickly. We were trying to be the Rays, but weren't smart enough to be the Rays. It's not about money. Why are the Rays winning the AL East with the lowest payroll? Because they make the smartest moves. By the way, what do you think of Stuart Sternberg as an owner? This is actually a perfect question.
He's the Rays owner, right? Is he the Rays owner?
Rays owner. What do you think of him?
Oh, man, that stadium they play in is a disaster. But I don't know you guys, correct me if I'm wrong, like part of the hurdles that they're climbing and trying to get their stadium deal is people hold the Marlins Park as an example. And it sort of poisoned the well.
Give me a break. They've been trying to get a stadium earlier than we were trying to get a stadium. So don't blame the Marlins for that.
He very clearly hires good baseball people.
So Stuart Sternberg is a good owner because he doesn't lose money.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't that make him a bad owner? Because the Rays haven't won a World Series. They've been competitive every year, but they're not willing to dip into their pocket to make an extra addition in order to get over the top and be even better than they are. So under your definition, Stuart Sternberg is a bad owner. Under mine, he's the number one owner in baseball. Ability to operate a business and win.
Credit to you, David Sampson, because I'll admit it, I was wrong. You have changed my perspective on my take on owners. I was holding something against Jerry Reinsdorf, and you exposed my consistencies. So credit to you, David Sampson. And I had no idea, flatly, that this G4 loan program existed at all.
Is it in the Google? I assume it's somewhere.
Yeah, like, why aren't more teams using this?
They are.
They are?
Yes.
Then why are so many teams still publicly fighting for public money? Because it's still owner's money. Wait, is there? There's a kickback to the owners if they don't go all the way into the G4? Do they just take whatever's left?
Kickback, public money, you don't have to pay back. G4 money is like just really good money that you can access at better rates than banks can. In Vegas, those guys, when they built the Vegas stadium, the LA stadium has used a ton of G4 money. They'll never be able to pay back the G4 money for the new LA stadium that Jerry Jones was such a big part of. The only scam is that the NFL is using its great credit that it has to access a huge amount of money to give to owners who then can say to fans like you that they're using their own money so they don't have to take heat the way other leagues and owners do for using even more public money.
Well, I feel like a sucker. I feel
not
exposed.
At all.
And you've changed my perspective on things. And so that's a good conversation. We have time to get into Speed Cubers. I have to really set up the national Zoom in like 5 minutes. So let's, in true Speed Cuber fashion, let's go through this because I finally saw it. I found it heartwarming and sad because, not just because one of the main characters featured in this documentary has autism, and there was just heartbreaking video of a mother trying to connect with her child in ways that I became so thankful that I personally didn't have to experience it. There was a point in the movie where they're talking about how their child at like 9 years old started pointing and seeing what they went through. I'm like, oh my God, thank God Juliet is pointing at stuff, because that's one of the signs if they're not pointing. And it being a parent really changes how you view those things. But I didn't get my happy ending. Spoiler alert. I didn't get my happy ending in this thing. It was really a relationship documentary. It was a human interest story. It wasn't actually about cubing.
Well, cubing was what they used in order to tell the story of a mother and a son and of a friendship. The real relationship that I liked was the friendship between the two top cubers. But I was obsessed with the fact that this exists. I don't have big enough hands. The way they cube with one hand, and when you look at all of them, even the ones who are not autistic, they're always cubing. They've got cubes in their hands and they're flipping with them and playing them and they're doing it. I found it fascinating. But before you let me go, I got to talk about the Eagles.
The history of the Eagles. Dan has sat down at the perfect time. Dan, you get to hear David Samson's review of what we believe to be the greatest rock doc ever, The History of the Eagles.
Stunned. So you told me to watch the Eagles. Is Dan really there?
Stunned that he didn't know about this documentary. And of course, without even having heard anything that you have to say on the subject, if Mike and I are telling you that it's really good, my guess is that you're really going to like it. You're not going to be disappointed by it, even if there are, you know, unreasonable expectations.
Yeah, I didn't even take a bathroom break during the 3+ hours, 3 hours and 57 minutes, including a 40-minute concert at the end. So the running time of the actual doc is about 3:13, let's say, and then they do a concert. I was fascinated by how the band was formed. I didn't know why they were called the Eagles, because they were tripping, and one guy saw an eagle where they were tripping, and that became the name of their band. Watching what happened between Henley and Fry was fascinating. I didn't realize that Joe Walsh was such a drug, had so many drug issues. And I just didn't realize the drama in that band. And I couldn't be happier knowing, first of all, they have so many great songs. The documentary goes deep inside both old and new footage, current interviews. Very sad watching it, though, knowing that it was filmed before Glenn Fry passed away. And just realizing that people who are rock stars, they really sacrifice their lives to give us something that gives us so much pleasure. I get so much pleasure from music, and I left that documentary so thankful that these people were willing to do cocaine and willing to do things that is not great for your long-term life in order to give me an outsized amount of pleasure. Thank you for that. The documentary is simply phenomenal.
David Samson, host of Nothing Personal. We will talk to you next week. We might change up the release schedule just based on what the Miami Heat do. Remember, if you want your Heat talk, check out the Big Suey today, tomorrow. Reaction across the Big Suey and the local hour. David Samson, check out his podcast, Nothing Personal with David Samson. Although today we found out that there's a little bit of a dent when it comes to the name, because we found something that was personal. David Samson, thank you so much for your time.